Hello and welcome to the IntraFish Podcast, where we bring you the most interesting and compelling seafood news. I'm Drew Cherry, Editor-in-Chief, joined by Executive Editor John Fiorillo. And we have a couple of topics that we want to dive into today. As usual, a very busy stretch of news at IntraFish and in the seafood industry, but wow, these two really stood out. The Alaska Senator Dan Sullivan was on the floor of the U.S. Senate yesterday and gave what you could only call a scathing rant against Russian seafood imports coming in via China. Now, following the invasion of Ukraine by Russia last year, the U.S. did, under the Biden administration, ban direct Russian seafood imports. That had an impact, in particular, on crab and the amount of crab coming into the U.S. market. Russia had a huge market for king crab and other crab species here in the United States. But the highest volume of Alaska pollock came via China. And China is critical for the Russian pollock fishery. If you recall, the Alaska / Russian pollock fishery is the world's largest single wild fishery outside of smaller fishmeal fisheries in terms of weight anyway. But by value, it's the most valuable fishery on the face of the planet in the Bering Sea. About, I guess you could say it's not rough. It's not exactly half. Russia takes a little bit more, but fair to say that it's basically split on both sides. Both sides have Marine Stewardship Council certification for their fish. All of that fish primarily makes its way into frozen products in Europe, into surimi, into Japan. A narrow span of product forms. And so the two suppliers compete with one another very heavily. Now, the Russian fishing sector obviously has run into a lot of closed doors. Not only did the U.S. Government stop direct imports, also other markets have either closed them out via high tariffs. Some companies have stepped away and moved towards other fish. But, you know, in general, Russian fish is still making its way into the market because of the amount that's reprocessed into China, via China and by other Asian countries, but primarily China. So the difference between these two, direct fishing in the United States, many of the factory trawlers that harvest pollock, the fish is frozen on board. So you get what's called single frozen pollock. The other side of the ocean in Russia, it tends to be harvested by vessels that are only capable of processing that fish into headed and gutted fish. That fish frozen, shipped to China, thawed, cut up, put into fillet blocks, frozen again, and then shipped to market. Those are the basic two components of how the Russian and American pollock fisheries operate in terms of getting product to market. Okay, we've got that down. Now, the issue is when you directly ban fish from Russia, that's one thing. But banning fish via China becomes quite a bit more complicated because you have to, number one, have a very good traceability system in place to stop that from coming in. And you have to be able to enforce that. But not only that, when you start closing that door, importers get very, very nervous because the amount of fish that continues to be processed in China is massive. So regardless of what's happened with China during the COVID lockdowns and some of the issues they've had, China continues to be one of the largest exporters of seafood into the United States, by far, right up there. So Sullivan wants to close that loophole, along with U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski and Congresswoman Mary Peltola, and several others. The problem is they're not exactly on the same page with every other single seafood company in the United States. And that has put the National Fisheries Institute, which represents the industry, and some other companies in kind of a weird position. Now, yesterday when Sullivan made his comments on the Senate floor, he was opposed by another U.S. Senator, Senator Ed Markey from Massachusetts, who I would say did not do his constituents, in particular the company Gorton's, which is one of the leading frozen fish brands and a subsidiary of Nippon Suisun Kaisha, a Japanese company. I don't think he did him any favors by highlighting that he was kind of acting on behalf of Gorton's by arguing against closing this loophole of allowing Russian fish into the United States via China. So I'm going to stop there with that preamble. And John, let's start talking about this. What are the merits and drawbacks of how this currently operates of allowing Russian fish to come in via China? What are your thoughts on whether or not this loophole gets closed?
Well, first thought is this is a wonderful example of the complicated supply chain of the global seafood industry. It, you know, we talk about it a lot, and people who don't understand how seafood gets from the water to their plates, I think they'd be amazed at how complicated the supply chains can be. And this is a stark example of that. Now, as it relates to this specific situation, I find myself sitting in two camps. I find myself personally thinking, why are we allowing this? Why are we allowing money to go back to Soviet or to Russia to fund, in part, as far as I can tell, the ongoing war in Ukraine? Why would we want to contribute in any way, directly or indirectly, to the terrible situation over there? So, on that front, I'm kind of, you know, in step with Sullivan on this. I, you know, it's a war machine that's been unleashed, and they have to fuel it somehow with money. And I think indirectly we're helping them do that. Now, on the other side, in the other camp, I'm sitting here and thinking, okay, companies like ConAgra that do Mrs. Paul's and Van de Kamp's, they use Russian. Captain D's, big fast food seafood chain, they use Russian. These businesses, as you mentioned, you know, we import a lot. We import a lot from China, not just pollock, but the importers in those businesses and others I mentioned would be, it'd be hard for them. Now, the next question is, can the Alaska pollock sector fill the void? No, I don't think they can. I would need Alaska expert on that, a pollock expert, but my top of the head thought is I don't think they can fill the void. So where would this pollock come from? So there's two distinct places that my mind sits, and they kind of oppose one another, but I guess I'm not really too bothered by Sullivan ranting and bringing this up for discussion, because everybody that you talk to, the minute those sanctions went into effect, the very first calls I started to receive, will they close a loophole with China? At the time, my answer was, I have no idea. My answer right now is, clearly not. And will this change that? I don't think so. But It might. It certainly has kicked it up to a higher level.
I disagree with you on that. I think this loophole is going to get closed. I think that there is, I think the effort that that Murkowski and Sullivan and several other legislators and groups are putting into this is going to be successful. And I think that for a couple of reasons. For one, in a way, there's not a whole lot of other levers that the US government can pull on Russia right now. They've sanctioned many of the oligarchs. They've got the direct sanctions. In terms of sanctioning products, there's not a whole lot of other thing and individuals, there's not a whole lot of things that the US government can do. And this is setting aside any arms or any other kind of support that will be provided to Ukraine. So I think this is one of those symbolic effort, well, not symbolic in the seafood industry, but I think that it will resonate beyond just the seafood industry because people will see it as one more way to tighten the screws on Vladimir Putin. So I think there could be a case made here, especially when the case is articulated that this is about protecting U.S. fishermen. We can argue about
Yeah,
that
but
a little bit.
what happens then when they get out there and they do that, and then Joe or Joanne Shopper goes and grabs her pack of Vandekamp fish fingers, and they're $1 more
Well,
expensive.
there you go.
I mean, do you think they're gonna fall on the sword about Russia for the fish sticks? I don't see it. But, they definitely, I mean, when you start drawing in Gorton's and some big name companies, as this has done in the last week, that can take it to another level. I agree with you. Whether it's enough to close this loophole or not, I mean, we just got done meeting with China and kind of apparently patching up some hurt feelings and all that. Is this, is this where we want to like pick a new fresh fight? I don't know. And I guess we'll have to see, but we got to also keep in mind that Russia is building a very high-tech brand new fleet of processing vessels and plants as well. So I mean, I don't know if any of this money goes there, there's just there's several things involved here, but again, Sullivan's comments, Murkowski's comments, they didn't really bother me. I have to say there's a part of me that totally says, yeah, you guys are right. Why are we giving them anything that might help?
So, I mean, I think there's a couple things that you said here that the there is political posturing here on the part of Murkowski and Sullivan. Obviously, they're representing their constituents. They don't know these issues very well, and the next step we're going to take in our talk here is going to be about another issue that they surely don't know much about. So they're representing their constituents, and that, of course, the Alaska industry, the Alaska pollock industry, does have a dog in the fight to continue to keep Russia out of the U.S. market. Absolutely. When you look at the volume coming in from Russia, it's a totally different situation than it is in Europe, where they have so much volume coming into that market from Russia via China. So here, you could argue that it wouldn't have the same strong impact on the consumer, number one. But second, I don't know, and this is why yesterday in the story that we wrote on it, they've been banging this drum for a while, for sure. But where I feel yesterday was different, and you just mentioned this, was the way that Markey kind of hid behind Gordon's. I mean, you know, and by the way, Gordon's is not the only company. The National Fisheries Institute, many other companies are opposing this. And so it's not just Gordon's. However, Gordon's sure got the brunt of this. And when you have a senator on the floor of the U.S. Senate saying, oh, yeah, really, it's because Gordon's is leading the charge. I mean, he was trying to save face about his position on Ukraine by saying it was his constituent that needed to look at it. There's so many things silly about that that I don't even know where to start. But I do think it's unfair to Gordon's because Gordon's does not use a lot of twice frozen pollock. I mean, Mitsui owns Unice, which is a major single frozen. It's a major processor of pollock in Alaska as well. So I don't think Gordon's wants to necessarily die on this hill. I think after this week, you are going to see probably Markey got a pretty angry call from Gordon's, I would guess, this morning. And I would also guess that you're not going to have a lot of companies if they see, oh, wow, so Alaska is going to make me look like some kind of poster child for this. I have to be standing out there arguing for allowing Russian fish into the U.S. It is not a good look, and I don't know that the money saved is going to be worth what could happen to the brand, because, you know, we're in a day of social media where a hashtag, you know, Gordon supports Putin is going to take off or whatever. And so to your point, John, about consumers, I have a hard time seeing how the powerful consumer groups, you know, National Fisheries Institute isn't that powerful compared to like Food Marketing Institute or, you know, whatever consumer groups are going to weigh in on these types of things. Then I think you see some action. If they were to say, this is going to raise our prices, we cannot handle this in this inflationary environment, I don't see a lot of people jumping in, especially if they have Senator Markey representing them, who will, you know, go out and say, "Ah, don't blame me, blame Gordon's."
Well, let's take a look at that a little bit. First of all, let's be clear: Gordon's uses plenty of Alaska pollock. They call it out on much of their packaging. I spend a lot of time in grocery stores looking at seafood, both frozen and fresh. And when I look at Gordon's, it seems to me that their value packs, which are their less expensive, those are the ones probably using imported from China pollock. So mischaracterize this as a lot of their, you know, an overwhelming amount is Russian origin, because I think that's probably untrue. However, okay, I'll take your point about the consumer groups getting involved. I don't see it either. But let's take a little piece of recent history as an example of consumer behavior, which is more what I'm interested in watching. Crab, you mentioned crab, king crab in particular. We have been getting so much of our supply from Russia over the years, more and more every year. And when the import ban came down on Russian seafood just after the war started, February 2022, you know, crab was not going to, there was no loophole. It was going to be banned. And unfortunately, they announced it in, I want to say March, Drew, but then they gave like this grace period to June. So there was this massive import of crab from Russia during that period. But also, in preparation for what was going to be no imports shortly thereafter, the price of king crab went through the sky. I believe, if I'm correct, it was over $40 a pound at Costco for a while. It's come back a little bit, and what happened? Well, we know exactly what happened because we have IRI data to watch. Crab sales went through the floor, just fell apart, disappeared, poof, gone. Now, I'm not saying that same dynamic would work with Pollock in this case, because Pollock is generally, you know, it's surimi in the U.S. or it's in the frozen case and sticks and stuff like that. But it does show us that consumers will punish you quickly and very quickly when it comes to seafood if those prices get slightly out of their comfort zone. So, you know, I don't think we're going to see any big consumer groups jump on this bandwagon, but I do think, you know, a little price volatility in your bag of fish sticks could have, you know, significant effects.
Yeah. Well, good point. And I guess we'll kind of see how this all plays out. I think there's sort of momentum here. I don't think it's just grandstanding, because it feels like it's a time, again, where there, it just feels like there's a, it's a time where there's going to be some, a need for some more action on Ukraine and soft action. There's only so much military, support I think the U.S. is willing to give here. So they're continually looking for softer ways that they can turn the screws. Now, the other thing that Sullivan said, and again, it's naive to think that Sullivan has all this data off the top of his head, right? His constituents are giving him a lot of this information, and that's part of how government works, is you, your constituents, especially ones that are powerful, are going to be feeding you, you know, ideas, requests, issues that they want you to bring to the Senate floor. So, so let's not be naive about that. This definitely isn't about just doing the right thing. This is also about benefiting constituents, about benefiting Alaska pollock producers in particular. When that became kind of most clear, I think, is when Sullivan went on sort of a mid-speech tirade against the Marine Stewardship Council in the middle of kind of what he was talking about with on Twice Frozen, which was really kind of neither here nor there in a way. I mean, it's fine, but clearly he needed to get this in there. And he mentioned, he said, the Marine Stewardship Council. And so so he chose to bring this up as part of this. And, you know, he laid into the MSC hard, which is actually the second time that an Alaskan has done so within the past month. So clearly we've got an effort that's probably not going to go away either on this Twice Frozen issue or on the Marine Stewardship Council, which I think is much – that's quite interesting. It's very interesting. Here's just a little bit of what he said. You know, Russian fisheries are certified as sustainable by the MSC. This is a joke. It's ridiculous. Shame on you, MSC, for helping fund the Putin war machine. And so it's – I think it puts the MSC in a very tough position. And I think they're running out of the ability to sort of not answer this question about whether or not the MSC logo should be carried on products that are harvested in Russian waters and certified to the MSC standard. First off, those fisheries were certified prior to Ukraine and have been for a long time, and they've been audited and certified. Those fisheries are considered well-managed fisheries under, you know, in terms of how they meet the Marine Stewardship Council certification. So that hasn't changed. Nothing has changed but the invasion of Ukraine. There's going to be problems during the recertification, because the certification to the MSC standard requires certification groups to be on the ground and doing auditing. And there's no significant international groups that I am aware of, or in any of our reporting, that are willing to send people over there to do this work. So they would need to do it by a Russian agency, presumably. But the larger issue, I believe, is whether or not the MSC should be allowing the use of its certificate on that fish. I personally believe that those fisheries, I think the scientists and researchers operating in Russia are very, very skilled, talented people by any accounts I've had from their counterparts in the United States and from others, that the management is really solid. And that won't change. What's happening in the fisheries management or the water won't change, I think. But
it has. It has already, right? Because I believe, and I believe this is with every fishery under the MSC program. Correct me if I'm wrong, and I often am, but doesn't every fishery have to be audited annually? And I'm not talking about a recert. That's like, I think the recert comes every 5 years. But I believe everyone has to go through an annual kind of checkup, like when you go to the doctor. Am I wrong on that?
I'm not sure about that. I'm honestly sure about that. I don't think so.
Okay. Well, if I'm right, and you don't think so, but I do. if I'm right, then they have not been sending folks over there to do that. So, but to your larger point, and I totally agree, these fisheries earn the MSC standard just like the pollock guys did. And you know, you could debate that all you want, but they are managed, they are from all measurements that we can see, they're well managed. And so, you know, from that point of view, they should be able to carry the label. But I just, if it's true that they're supposed to be audited, that's just part of the procedure for every fishery. And if that cannot be done, then the MSC has a problem. They're not following their own rules. And but again, I'll have to look and see if that's truly the case as far as annual audits. But either way, your other point about when the recertification comes up, you need bodies over there that can look at everything. And if that can't happen, that can't happen.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and as you said, okay, the management of the fisheries so far doesn't seem to have changed. Let me come back to that in just one second, though. The MSC has put itself in this position of kind of saying, nope, we don't get into politics. We don't worry about this. It's sad what's happening, but our certificate is put onto certified fisheries. And that's all we do is somebody gets certified, they can use their certificate, which is maybe technically true, but the MSC has definitely been involved in politics before, like it or not. This is something I'm going to tackle in a commentary too, by the way. So I don't want to. I'll leave some of my thoughts for the commentary and not for this. But for example, the Northeast mackerel fishery, there has been a political stalemate in getting agreement on the quota allocation between the countries there, the coastal states. And the MSC, if you'll recall, pulled its certificate saying, we don't feel like the management here is working out. It's up to, you know, not up to par here. We're not going to certify these fisheries. We're not going to allow the use of our certificate on these fisheries. And so it's almost impossible for the MSC to not be involved somehow in these politics and have an opinion, especially because it's an NGO that touts transparency, that touts social accountability. They do have a social, a burgeoning social element to their program. It's not a major part of their program as it is with some other certification programs, but it's a part of it. And I don't think you get more I don't think that a country that is doing what Russia is doing, especially on the doorstep of Europe, I don't think that it's I don't think that you can necessarily call products coming out of the country sustainable in that sense. If you're looking at it holistically, again, the management of the fishery and the health and sustainability of the actual biomass, probably fine. But the other element of this, if the MSC says, well, it's just certification of our, it's just use of our MSC label, we don't get involved in politics. So they did with the Northeast Atlantic mackerel. Now, Russia, you could call it posturing or not, but they've said, okay, you know what? We could set a unilateral quota in the Western Bering Sea for pollock, or you've kicked us out of ICES, which happened in the North Atlantic, and the ICES gives advice on harvesting Atlantic cod and other North Atlantic species. They kicked out Russia because of the invasion, and Russia's really talked a lot about how they might set their own quotas or do their own management. Now, again, that's politics on the ground. I think the scientists in Russia are probably just pulling out their hair going, oh, come on, to put them in this terrible situation, because these are fisheries researchers. They want the stock to be healthy, and Russian fishing companies want the stock to be healthy. And they're, of course, caught in this crossfire as well. And, you know, some of the companies do have links to oligarchs. And so you might say, well, you know, so what? But then many don't, right? Many Russian fishermen are just trying to fish and just trying to sell their products. But, you know, the MSC, I think, is going to have a very, very difficult time not taking a stance. And the problem for them, even more so, is that it really, really, really doesn't look good. Alaska pollock makes up a massive volume of the Certified Marine Stewardship Council seafood across the world. Massive volume. Not just from Alaska, but from Russia as well. And it just does not look good, because they now are funded by their logo licensing fees, which that's paid for by people using the license and major companies purchasing the products or purchasing the fish and then putting them on products. They are primarily major food manufacturers, right? So you're talking about Nomad, which is Bird's Eye Igloo in Findus, the largest frozen fish producer, branded frozen fish producer in the world. People like Frosta, another major German producer, people like Young Seafood. So those companies are in a really, really tough spot, because they use a lot of twice frozen Russian pollock in their fish fingers and other frozen fish products. And they are facing all the inflation that everybody else is. And so while there have been some sanctions put in place, they very, very much want that Russian fish to keep flowing. And as long as they have it flowing and put it into their products and use the MSC logo, the MSC will make licensing fees from it. So it's really not a good look for any NGO. And I just, John, I don't see how the MSC is not going to need to come out more forcefully on this. You know, they've given us comments that have been pretty mealy-mouthed, but I think they're going to need to come out and be much more forthright about how they feel about all this. And I don't know where it lands. I don't know where they would end up and what would happen to the organization if they did that.
Well, they came out and you know, didn't have any trouble with the Maine lobster fishery and yanking its MSC certification when you know, there were court cases and challenges to that fishery and its interaction with right whales, even though the fishery has never directly entangled a right whale or killed a right whale that we know of for decades, if not longer. Anyways, They didn't have any problem coming out with that one. This, you know, coming out and opposing that politically, I guess you'd say. But as you mentioned, I mean, Pollock is their powerhouse. I mean, it generates, not only is it, you know, one of the big metric tonnage fisheries that they can talk about, but as you said, it generates a lot of their revenue now through logo licensing. Back in the day, MSC survived on grants and the donations of Packard and Pew and those big foundations. Those days are gone. Most of their revenue, and it's the majority now, comes from logo licensing. So, like any company, you know, that's a big basket of business. And you know, you think twice, three times, four times before upsetting that, I imagine.
Yeah. Well, and yeah, I think the again, the big frozen fish producers, while they've started to find ways to pivot, they haven't really made they use so much twice frozen that it's almost impossible for them to make sort of a massive overnight shift here. Now, I ask a executive in the Pollock sector actually just yesterday whether or not the twice frozen, the volume of twice frozen that's purchased in Russia, or sorry, purchased in Europe from Russia, if there's any way that single frozen pollock from the US would be able to replace any significant amount of that volume. And it actually turns out that it's something the Alaska industry is looking at right now to try to sharpen that case a bit. So I think, obviously, any markets that the Alaska pollock industry can develop, they're going to develop, and they obviously there's a drive right now to tighten the screws on Russia. I think the Alaska pollock industry sees the opportunity here, but it's I think a much more complicated scenario in Europe than it is in the United States, but. You know, as with the MSC, this all raises a lot of questions about how to deal with Russian product, full stop, and whether or not a company purchasing Russian raw material should be, quote unquote, Russia shamed. I don't know how I feel about that. I really don't, and I think it's a difficult issue for a lot of people in the seafood industry to know. How to feel about, you know, interestingly enough, when I was in Barcelona, I talked to Nitesh Paul, who's the CEO of Polar Seafood Ukraine. And, you know, Paul has, you know, of the people impacted by Russia's invasion of Ukraine, he and his company have been among the hardest hit in the seafood industry, if not the hardest hit, except I guess that one company actually had its factory hit. However, what it's done for his personal life and for his employees, and it's just been devastating. And so I asked him in an interview, you know, do you feel like Europeans are doing enough to turn away Russian seafood? And he said something really interesting. And he said, if you would have asked me 6 months ago, I would have said no. I would have said we need to stop buying everything. I would have said to be more aggressive. And he said, but I've softened my stance on that a bit because I believe that there are companies that are trying to just do business and get on with their lives that are not. They're not in favor of the invasion. Yes, this is their government, but they're not, you know, they're really, you know, his point was they're really not feeling that that this is something that they can influence. And so I just thought that was very interesting, and it added, you know, to me, somebody who's so directly impacted by that, for him to say that, to provide that kind of nuance was interesting.
Yeah, and I think that goes for US companies and probably any company. I mean, there are plenty that probably no support whatsoever for what's going on there, but they're businesses and they employ people, and people need jobs, especially in this time of inflation and all the kind of economic disruption. So they got a delicate dance to do there, but I mean they probably think their first priority is to protecting their business and their employees, and I don't know how you can argue with that. That seems pretty legit to me. So, but yeah, I mean, if Sullivan's done nothing, he's resurrected some really good debate on this. Again, a year, here we are, a year and more than a year later, and we can't let this just be forgotten or fall to the back pages of the newspaper. But yeah, it's interesting for sure.
Yeah. Well, let's pivot to a different subject. So last week was our Future of Seafood Forum. We held it in New York City, brought together a very interesting, diverse crowd of top executives. And our aim and our goal was to try to look at some of the pressing issues that are either holding the seafood industry back or opportunities the seafood industry has for growth. And how the sector might capitalize on those, or in what ways it's failing to capitalize on some of its opportunities. So we talked about a wide range of topics, but John and I wanted to focus on one issue here that I thought was probably one of the more defining issues, which I thought was kind of interesting because when we were planning the event and kind of thinking about the topics. This didn't jump out as sort of a central theme so much as I saw it as, okay, this is something interesting that we need to have on our agenda to discuss, and that's cellular seafood. So among the panels that I moderated was Shannon Cosentino Rausch of Finless Foods and Justin Kolbeck of Wild Type. Two cellular seafood companies, and to get an update on where the technology is, how it's advanced in the past year, when it might be hitting shelves commercially, what it's going to need to succeed. And although we've been writing about this for a long time, John, or at least the last 3 to 5 years, it's been on our radar, and much more so as it's developed in the past year or two. It's definitely not been one. It's been novel, right? It's been, oh, this is kind of interesting. I wonder when this is going to affect things. But what I saw in last week's event was a lot of the what I'm going to call conventional seafood executives were really, really engaged on this. And there, during the networking sessions, in sort of conversations you could see in the corner, it was clear that. This time around, I think there's a different feeling, and maybe it's the way that Kolbeck and Rausch really articulated this. But one of the things they did on in the discussion was they said, "Look, we're not plant-based seafood. This is a different. We are actual seafood, number one, and we're not out to compete. We're recognizing that there is going to be a massive shortage." And we need more ideas for protein. And that could be any kind of protein, but we need more ideas for sustainable protein, scalable protein. And they see their researchers have said, hey, you know what? Or their look at the market has said, hey, this is a good area. Let's look at seafood. I mean, they could do this with anything, they could do this with any bit of meat that you would want. But they see seafood, given its health benefits and given that there's opportunity for it to grow, they see this as a place they wanted to focus on. Now, they admitted, because I think they were given the opportunity, they haven't really been asked this so much, I think. They said, look, we don't know what we're doing when it comes to processing, marketing or reaching the consumer. That's not what we do. We're PhDs, we're researchers, we're looking at regulatory issues. We are looking at ways to actually scale this and get this to market at some point. But they really reached out and said, hey, people in the conventional industry, we need your help. We don't want you to think of us as a competitor. We don't want you to think of something that should be kind of sidelined. We really want you to look at it as something as an add-on and a way that we both can benefit, as one more sort of product in your supply chain. And you could see, as I said, the conversations that were being had were really, really interesting, and some that I sat in on in networking. It was just fascinating because you could hear, Roush and, somebody from the Pollock or Scallop sector kind of exchanging ideas. And you suddenly saw these people that are thinking in a very conventional way and probably haven't been challenged to change their business models in a long time, suddenly in this position of, oh, wait a minute, I've got something to teach this new upstart emerging sector. So I think we're going to see a real shift here, John, where we're going to see a lot more companies embracing it. And I certainly walked away realizing that, yeah, if this can scale, and I certainly think it can, it will absolutely be a part of the seafood supply chain. And you know what? It may be a lot sooner than we think, because we went from a touchscreen iPhone being launched to all of us having these things in our pockets in a very, very, very short period of time.
Yeah, well, I can't agree more. I mean, just this week, the FDA approved quote-unquote cultivated meat, in this case chicken, to be sold in the U.S., so horse out of the barn, as they say. I totally agree with the separation of plant-based and cell culture. I mean, plant-based to me its ceiling is very low and limited, and you're already seeing that. I just don't think there's enough value proposition there for a general consumer. You know, they'll have the people who want that, but I don't see that eating into seafood, traditional seafood's market share in any meaningful way. Cellular, however, let's keep in mind, these are stem cells from fish. This is fish. This isn't, legumes mashed into something that resembles fish. This is fish. Now, it's made in a lab, which is an important distinction, but it's still fish. So, assuming these guys do scale this, and there's so much money pouring into the technology right now, it's hard for me to believe that they won't, but, you know, we'll see. I think any seafood company with an ounce of smarts would be doing exactly what you said. They'd be looking to these groups to see where there's commonality, where they can work together. Because at some point, let's remember way back in the day, at some point there was just wild seafood. And then this stuff started coming. Oh, it's farm seafood. Oh, yeah. Well, we sell wild, wild, wild. That's seafood. This stuff isn't real seafood. Well, here we are. Not too long down the road from that, and farm seafood accounts for a higher percentage of global seafood production than wild. And that is always going to be the case, and the spread's going to grow more and more and more. But the companies that once poo-pooed farmed fish and, you know, claim they would never sell it, you know, blah, 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 well, that's all gone away. I mean, everybody, whether they're Alaska producers or whomever they are, they all sell wild and farmed and, you know, together, and it's one big happy family. Same scenario is going to unfold here, you know, but I think, to your point, I think the industry's a little smarter right now than maybe back in the farm wild debate. And I think it will probably not let this devolve into, oh, cell, it's, made in a lab by crazy mad scientists. And, I don't think they'll let it devolve into that type of, debate, so to speak. So, and they shouldn't, because this is the legit competition. This is going to change this industry over the next decade and more. This, not plant-based, this, cell-based. So, you can watch the train go by, or you can hop on and, help out. I don't know. But that's just my take. I could be completely wrong.
I find myself in agreement with you for once, John. So this is a good peaceful détente. Is that how you pronounce it? Détente. This is a good peaceful détente.
There's no détente. It's détente.
I like adding a little more flavor to my words. So, anyway, thank you everybody for joining us. Just a reminder, you can find us on intrafish.com 24/7. You can subscribe to our newsletters or several newsletters to kind of fit any news need or topic that you're interested in. If you're a subscriber, even better, you could sign up for our alerts to get specifically the news that you want to get, be that company, species, whatever it might be. Also, make sure and download our app. So that is available on the App Store and on Google Play. It's a great way to get our content on the go. There's some really cool features. You can also get push notifications for recommended stories that we feel like you absolutely must read, and breaking news, which of course we dig up a lot of it. So if you want to be first on that, best way to do it is get the app. All right, folks, we will talk to you next time.